Okay, let's see. Celica, a Cord, a Beretta.
Negan, I found it. There's a DeLorean for sale in Fort Richmond.
Hey, guys, what is with all this mess? There's copies of the Auto Trader everywhere.
We found it, Dan. A DeLorean.
Isn't that the junk heap of a car they used in Back to the Future?
Bingo, Dan. I'm headed back. Back to 1979. To the time before Portage and Main was first closed, causing 46 years of silliness, stupidity and insanity in Winnipeg, creating division and debate that's occupied my entire life.
Great Scott! This might be our only chance to know what it's like to cross Portage and Main as a pedestrian.
Yeah, I hate to be the negative guy here, but, you know, do you guys actually know how to build a time machine? And listen, I really hate to tell you this, but Portage and Main is reopened. I mean, it's just been reopened. There's really no need for you to go back.
Dan, you're a dream killer.
You know what? I don't care. I have to go back. Back to a time before everything went so terribly wrong.
Okay, don't let me stand in the way of your dreams, but, you know, please be careful. When you get back to 1979, don't step on any butterflies or anything, or you'll change our present. One wrong move, and thanks to the space-time continuum, we could end up in a timeline where everybody's being mean and the world's on fire.
So, kind of like the reality we're living in now?
Heavy.
The Winnipeg Free Press proudly presents, in partnership with CJNU 93.7 FM, Negan and the Lone Ranger. Here are your hosts, Negan Sinclair and Dan the Lone Ranger Lett.
Welcome, everybody, to
the future. Welcome to the future.
Yeah, back to the future.
Of Winnipeg, yeah. As Portage and Main opens this week.
And so get the beeper ready, Adam. Welcome to the old podcast.
Is that supposed to be a record of how many seconds in?
No, we did the opening where we mentioned Back to the Future and 1979. Like, way to go, Gramps. You know, like.
Well, first for the record I grew up on that film. I was quite excited that I got to jam that into an intro, and I think we did. You did a wonderful Doc Brown over there, Adam.
Thank
Way
you.
To go. Nice work.
I have to ask, 1, 2, or 3, which is the best movie? There is only one correct answer.
Three is pretty good. 2 is and 1 is amazing.
The best.
There you go.
Yeah, of course.
You got it right.
Lots happening in Winnipeg this week. And we, of course, we want to get to our feature interview in just a minute. But huge congrats to Nahit Nenshi, friend of the podcast.
Friend of the podcast, absolutely, is now a member of the Alberta legislature, will be the leader of the official opposition.
Edmonton Strathcona, I think, is the name of the MLA.
In Alberta, they don't seem to be able to do the name of a provincial riding in less than 3 terms.
That's right.
It has to be double, like a, name, dash, name, dash, name. Because it, you know, they have to carry really large business cards.
It's because Alberta is known for inclusivity. That's
that's not what it's known for.
But huge congratulations to Nahit Nenshi, who's been off previous guest.
Yep.
Also, was very tied deeply to the opening of Portage and Main, having you've talked about many times as having just aghast at the huge concrete barriers that blocked pedestrian traffic.
A number of years ago, I interviewed him in a webcast from the News Cafe. Those of you who remember what the News Cafe was on McDermott Avenue, respect. It was a really funny interview where I interviewed him about being the mayor of Calgary, and he was in town for the Federation of Canadian Municipalities event. And so I interviewed him, and then I said, well, you know, Mayor Nenshi, thank you very much for doing this with me. And he stopped me and he said, aren't you going to ask me about Portage and Main? And I said, I don't know. Am I going to ask you about Portage and Main? He goes, ask me about Portage and Main. And so I asked him, and it was not only was it so articulate, because he is like one of the most articulate elected officials, but I literally changed my opinion on Portage and Main during that interview. He convinced me that it was a big issue, because I had actually written a column saying, like, walk one block north or south and cross the street and shut up about it, right? And I completely 100% pivoted on the issue. That's how persuasive he is. Danielle Smith should be worried, you know?
Yeah. And in other big Winnipeg news this week, huge hockey news. Jonathan Toews is coming home and yeah. Jennifer Botterill in the Hockey Hall of Fame.
In the Hockey Hall of Fame. Now, you know, as we all well know, I continue to stalk Will Arnett in all manner possible, trying to get a Canadian Will Arnett, you know, a star of stage and screen and big screen and movie. I don't know that if he does any live theater.
In all legal ways.
Yeah.
You're not doing anything underhand here.
Not yet. Okay. But I'm working on trying to find his address, and then I'm thinking about hiring a self-driving car and just driving back and forth in front of his place in Los Angeles. No, but as God is my witness, we will get Jonathan Toews on this podcast.
I think this is our new call.
Yep, that it's I'm calling in all of my favor. one favor that I have with people who are connected to this, and we're gonna. It is actually great. It's of course, like, you know, he's literally on a contract where they're paying him per game. So it's not like they're convinced.
It's probably the most incentive-driven contract I've ever seen in my life. Although he does stand if he hits every barometer, like $6-7 million, which is incredible. $2 million up front, and then sort of different incentives. I hope that his health is great. I hope that he has a good return home. I hope everybody welcomes him. Jennifer Botterill, how well deserved is that? Gave life, soul to the country. Showed up at Olympics, injured, fought hard. Was during those dynasty teams, you know, a big part of the dynasty. And as part of this history of Winnipeg athletics, that of people who never fail to show up for the national team.
And I honestly believe she is such a value add to the Sportsnet hockey broadcast team. You know, like, totally. I actually like all of the people they have there, but you know, BX and Elliot Friedman, whatever, and Ron McLean, of course, is a legend. But she's fantastic, and I think it's another story of a Winnipegger who, thankfully, still comes back to Manitoba and cottages. That's where she found out about her Hockey Hall of Fame. She got in off the water. Was it West Hawk Lake or something like that?
Oh, that's actually a very similar to Connor Hellebuck winning the Hart Trophy and Vezina was off on the water and came home, and all the people there. Third most important Winnipeg story, not in any particular order, but clearly crucial and important, is we are seeing the mass return of fire evacuees, people who have been removed. Particularly Flin Flon was the highlight this week. And previous to that, there were some people returning to First Nations, many of them that were spending weeks. Many people missed their graduation, and there was a really beautiful ceremony that the University of Winnipeg, the Winnipeg School Division, put on for those who were fire evacuee graduates. Mm-hmm. But this is going to impact people for generations. Many mental health workers from Winnipeg flew ahead of time to Flin Flon so that they could welcome the new the people who were coming back.
Yeah, I mean, it was messy, the whole evacuee thing, from time to time. But honestly, I also think, though, the people who coordinated this thing, the effort to bring all these people to Winnipeg, you know, respect. Like, it could have been a disaster. And parenthetically, I'd like to say to the moron who keeps emailing me and telling me that the wildfires in northern Manitoba and the Whiteshell are the product of bad forest management, that you're a moron. And
you know nothing about science.
Yeah. And when the next major wildfire season, which will be, of course, next season, strikes, I hope they take your cottage first. Moron.
It's a little dark. Yeah. That's a little dark.
No, but it's seriously, it's like after the eighth or ninth email, it's like, oh man.
We get a few of those showing up at our live events as well.
Yeah.
For those, you know, I spent a lot of time down at the donation centers, at the convention center. I wrote a column about kind of driving through the downtown, and every stop I made, I was encountering a fire evacuee or someone impacted by the fires. This didn't just impact people directly coming from the 17,000 that left their homes. It was also the impacts on frontline services, paramedics, people in the justice system, people in the healthcare system, people in hotels, people in supermarkets. I mean, this impacted an entire city, but also an entire province. And I think I like to think that on top of this, that we maybe learned a thing or two about how to handle emergencies that may be coming in the future. Yeah. I hope the mistakes that we made, that we learned how, A, we can mobilize quickly. I also learned about the generosity of Winnipeggers. They actually stopped accepting clothing. They got so much clothing.
Yeah, like all the fire stations and whatever had to put up signs saying they got so much stuff. And no, I mean, like people caring for people. And, you know, I think initially there was some concern that it was going to be, you know, a little, you know, kind of hairy, you know, like, I mean, displaced people, you know, living in a, in some of them, like living away from their home community, really for the first time in their lives. No, like it's like, and it's also good to remember too, like, I think we city boys like me, I'm not putting you in this. I am putting Adam in that category, though.
Town,
he's a city boy.
About, you know, town.
But, you know, like we have this assumption, you know, that, that people who live in northern, remote, and rural areas are, you know, kind of less, I suppose.
Different. Well, I mean, they certainly have different ways that people have expectations or understandings of civic services, which are often not even there.
But man, oh man, like I don't know a lot of, like I don't myself, and I don't know a lot of people in my friends in the city who could uproot for weeks and weeks and weeks to an entirely different place and be generally well adjusted and positive about it. And
sometimes, you know, we're talking like 5-6 members of a family in a 2-bed hotel room for weeks at a time. I interviewed a family over at a hotel near the airport, and just the stress they were under was incredible. And in fact, they were working every day to try to keep things going. And if I could give one big kudos, of course, all the great civic services, many of the arenas were being used for, and so the mental health care staff, some of them were volunteers and worked 24-hour days. But the Indigenous organizations in the city, I think sometimes they get a rough ride by various members of the public thinking, okay, so what is exactly Chiefs organizations do? Well, this is exactly what they do. So this was coordinated directly from the Southern Chiefs organization, the Assembly of Manitoba Chiefs, Manitoba Kiwetnuk Ogamuk, which is the Northern Chiefs organization, was central because that was all of their membership that were coming down, or many of their members. And they were the key, and they're only about an 8-person office.
Yeah, it's, you know, I said, like people caring for people, you know, in a time of need. I think the underlying, you know, sort of depressing part of the story, of course, is the idea that this is our new normal now. Especially, I don't know, like I'm sort of hoping that somehow Mother Nature can throw a little more water on northern areas to make them a little more resilient to wildfires. But, you know, like, my God, you know, don't build pipelines. Don't make it harder to make electric vehicles. Like, for God's sake.
I think there's lots, hopefully, that we can learn from all of this. And speaking of learning, let's get to our feature interview this week. We have an exciting time in that, you know, on Saturday Night Live, they have these kind of, you come on for the fifth time
kind of thing.
You get
a jacket.
You get a jacket. Well, in our podcast, the t-shirts that have never shown up yet, which are on order in my head. we have a special thing when you reach the third time of a visit on the podcast.
You're supposed to get a t-shirt.
You get to be called friend of the podcast and a promise of a shirt that will probably never show up.
Yeah. I'm not sure the budget will allow for like blazers with crests on them, but, you know, maybe I don't know.
Well, our feature guest is coming for his third time on the podcast.
Well, and actually, if I'm not mistaken, he might have been, was he not our very first guest? Close to being the first guest.
It's like, been so long and so many episodes.
18 years ago when we first did the podcast.
Weren't you just talking about grandpas just a minute ago? Scott Gillingham, you know, one thing about Scott is I've you know, I may be tied with Brian Bowman as the mayor that I see most often. I don't know. Yeah. He's just at every event.
Yeah.
He's always out there and he's very reachable and very communicable. Like if you go up to him, he's friend, always engaging, want to talk about the city, and he's very passionate. And as you'll see in the feature interview today.
So we'll go now to our feature interview with Mayor Scott Gillingham. We're very happy to have the mayor of Winnipeg. Can I call you Your Worship, or can I call you Scott?
I prefer Scott.
Yeah.
Your Worship is I know it's you know, the historically
only on the weekend.
Honorific. Only on the weekend. But it's a pretty heavy. It's a pretty heavy handle. So Scott is good.
Okay, so Scott, this is, as you can deduce right by now, this is Mayor Scott Gillingham making his third appearance, I think.
You better be careful. You're starting to become what's called friend of the podcast.
Friend of the podcast. So
he's getting dangerously close to being owed a t-shirt.
Yes, no. So a really important first question, just to get it, you know, things going. What have you done? Like, what, seriously, man, what have you done? We are literally almost below Portage in Maine, and it's like the barriers are gone, and there's pristine white sidewalks there.
Overnight.
Well, it did, you know, but seriously, man, what have you done? You must be like, you know, you must be getting like, people must be so mad at you right now.
It's funny. I guess Winnipeggers are generally polite people because I have not got a lot of pushback recently about opening Portage to Maine to pedestrian traffic. I think, you know, once we made the decision, this is what we're going to do. We're going to open it up to pedestrians. You know, there was an initial, I think, flurry of people that were very supportive, emails to my office and some complaints, but it's really, really died down. I think what I'm hearing now is people look at the construction that is almost completed, the few temporary barriers that are up, you know, at the time of this, they were recording this, and people are excited. I'm hearing so much positive. People are really, really pleased, and people are saying, hey, it looks like an intersection, which is you know, we have thousands of all around Winnipeg, and so people are really looking forward to being able to cross.
Remove brutalist concrete structures.
I don't know inspire people to feel it's open, or you know, I wrote a piece about the Globe and Mail, you know, about the opening of Portage, Maine, and so I had to interview a lot of Winnipeggers, and of course, we're talking to an outside Winnipeg audience, so I had to think of the ways and do a lot of deep diving into the history, and it's pretty amazing that such a complex issue that created all of this vision back in 1979, and then all this division, really a lot of rancor. People using terms like eyesore and people using terms like confusion. And then suddenly just in 1 year, boom, the whole thing shifts after a whole lot of hand-wringing. How does that feel?
It feels good. I think we just, you know, the decision needed to be made. We saw the price tag, the initial price tag of repairing the underground membrane to protect the underground. And that would be 5 years, up to 5 years of construction delays and construction project going on in the intersection. And we just said, look, with this price tag, with that many years of construction delays, and what really the big thing is, for me, it's the future of our city. I try to say this and look at things through this lens. What decision do Winnipeggers 20 years from now need us to make today? And when I look at opening Portage of Maine to pedestrian traffic, I think 20 years from now, those Winnipeggers want us to make this decision today. So we have made the decision. It's been 45 years of debate about whether to open or not. We've ended the debate. We're opening it. For business in the downtown, for residents in the downtown, for pedestrians in the downtown, I think this is a good decision.
So 45 years of debate and hand-wringing, whatever. What are you going to do with your extra time now?
Oh, Dan, I wish.
Like, I think I talk about anything at City Hall now. Is there anything worth talking about now?
There are so many projects that are yet to get going. In all seriousness, like we've got to work very hard and consistently on tackling, you know, crime and safety in the downtown. The ongoing challenges of homelessness with people living unsheltered, they're just persistent. They're relentless, those issues. And so there's no end of the thing.
Well, I mean, one leads into the other, I think, because as is on all things in Winnipeg, they all interrelate in some way or another. You close the bathrooms downtown and it's a spike in addiction. You know, like these things are interrelated. And so what do you think will be the biggest positive outcome of opening pedestrian traffic? Will it be that there'll be more presence and therefore crime will go down? Will it be that more people on the surface, even in the wintertime, be interacting with each other? There's a better spirit in the city. What do you see?
I think all of that and more. You know, opening Portage and Main to pedestrian traffic is not going to fix downtown's future. But it's one of the puzzle pieces, I believe, in a lot of other pieces that are happening. I mean, you take a look at what the Manitoba Métis Federation is doing with their renovation and investment right at the corner of Portage and Main of the old Bank of Montreal building to become the National Métis Heritage Center. That's going to be – I just think now – I was talking to President Chartrand the other day. I said, you know, frankly, already your building looks really inviting because those barriers are gone. And people look already like they're, you know, ready to be welcomed in, even though that project is a couple of years from being completed. But – residential development happening at the Forks, ongoing development happening in the Exchange, Wewanay at the Bay, the old Bay building with Southern Chiefs organization, Portage Place, Broadway, there's the renovation, the transformation of the Canada Revenue Agency building to a hotel, the Market Lands. All of these projects are happening right now, investment happening and more, simultaneous at the same time as opening Portage and Main. I think, you know, Portage and Main is the intersection that is the connection point for all of the quadrants of downtown. And I just think that all of this work happening, including the changes on Graham Avenue, I think all of it coming together over the next couple of years, you know, I believe we'll see a lift in the downtown.
So I wrote a column that pretty much just mirrored your exact narrative
it
there.
And I appreciated it.
Yeah. And in the day after I wrote my column at which I said that it's not transformative on its own, but the lesson of Portage and Main, the fact that we can actually get something done, could be transformative, and that, you know, it was time to sort of look at creating, like closing down some streets, putting, you know, making it pedestrian friendly. So I'm going to give myself credit that you read my column and then the very next day announced that.
I picked up the phone.
Yeah, it said, close Graham Avenue. No, that's one of those, truth be told. I wish I knew it when I wrote the column. Mm-hmm. But anyways, no, but okay. So there was a bit of a stealth attack on that one. I know that that was always one of the options. Graham Avenue had been a transit mall with the Winnipeg Transit reconfiguration coming in. Portage and Main reopening, the opportunity to kind of create something that, you know, was more pedestrian friendly.
Right.
Did you kind of hold that back and bring, like, did you want it out at the same time as Portage and Main to kind of connect the dots or?
Yes, we did. I think to show that there's change that is happening. We've been talking about change, but now these are all interrelated. The opening of Portage and Main to pedestrian traffic, the change, massive change in our transit system to our new transit network, which takes buses off Graham Avenue, which means we can reimagine Graham Avenue. At the opening or at the announcement of Graham Avenue, one of the things I said is I think, you know, we sometimes, certainly politically, or maybe even a city, we get a little bit worried if we try something and it fails. I said, we have the permission to fail here. We're not looking to fail, but let's try some things, some initiatives on Graham Avenue. It's almost like a blank slate. Let's try a few things. And some of them are going to work. Let's go with them. There'll be a couple things that might not work. Let's abandon them, move on to the next initiative. We do see other cities throughout Canada and the United States that have these pedestrian malls, as we call them. They're streets that have been shut down. Either they're shut down to vehicle traffic all the time or at certain hours of the day. And it attracts investment, it attracts people. And when you've got people, more feet on the street, the safer it is as well. You talk to people who, let's say, attend Nuit Blanche annually. Mm-hmm. And I've, you know, been through, walked around all through the downtown on the night of Nuit Blanche late at night with people. And I said, do you feel safe? Well, of course.
Yeah.
It's 11 o'clock, 11:30 at night. Fringe festival.
Jazz festival.
Like all of that. Yeah. Exactly. And when there's more people, there's a sense of safety. And so, Graham Avenue, coordinating the timing of that with the change in the bus network and Portage and Main, all intentional.
So one of the other issues I brought up at that point is whether, you know, this could be catalytic to other parts of downtown. Like Graham and Portage and Main are kind of linked because of the transit issue. But, you know, like I have long sort of dreamed of Albert and Arthur you know, which have been closed in the past, you know, to facilitate summer festivals downtown. And, you know, and it really comes into focus. I was in the UK twice this year. My son's going to school in Ireland. And, you know, it doesn't matter. Like, a town of 15,000 people, a city of 500,000 people, you go to the core and you know that the core of the core
right.
will be closed to vehicles. And it's all serviced by a very sophisticated transit infrastructure so that, you know, people who need to get in and out of downtown can do it without driving their cars. And, you know, I was in Manchester in May, and it's just like 11 degrees and the patios are full, and, you know, and it's just, it's so sensible and civilized and whatever. Is there, like, is this all that, is Graham Avenue going to eliminate our tolerance for this kind of thing? Or, you know, can we look at maybe Graham Avenue and then say, okay, come on, let's get the rest of this done, you know, because they're really, the Exchange District is just desperate for something.
I think the Exchange, I agree with you. I think the Exchange District is ripe for it. And just the setting is fantastic as well, with the historic buildings, and it's just such a good feeling being there. And as Nigan said, when it's things like Fringe Fest and Jazz Fest, that some of those closures are already happening. I think one of the things that, you know, I would really encourage all listeners is the call for patience, because it's not like we're going to, you know, have the buses off of Graham Avenue Sunday and Monday start the closure of Graham Avenue and allow pedestrians there. Mm-hmm. And we're going to have 20,000 people there, you know, on Tuesday. These are early steps for us as a city. So it's going to take a little bit for this to build up and momentum to build. Ultimately, what we want to see is Graham Avenue. We want to see more businesses invest and more businesses flourish there. And some of these, by making some of these changes, the hope is that it is a step toward encouraging, incentivizing investment from the private sector to come set up shop, you know, along Graham Avenue, open a storefront on, you know, on Portage Avenue or Main Street near Portage of Maine, because you're going to have more people walking past your store again. So this is a first step, but it's going to take months, years to build. Mm-hmm. And I think we have to give ourselves a collective patience to get there.
The patience is this tension that goes in Portage and Maine, which is very palpable, very noticeable between government and business. And if you go back to 1982, again, I did this all this historical deep dive into the archive. And the biggest problem in the early stages of Portage and Maine was after the first shop opened up, all the ox cart routes were being blocked by businesses that were plopping themselves right in the middle of the ox cart route because they wanted traffic. And so what happened was, of course, in the 1960s, this drive towards a commuter city, all the businesses headed the decision was made to drive all business, storefront business, particularly underground. And so now we have what's called the circus, Four Corners, in which we're sitting in it now, where there's all these storefronts that are underground, literally of lacking of access to the second question I want to ask you, which is about the disenfranchised population. But before we get to that, we have a crisis for many of these businesses that we've then driven underground for 46 years. Many of them have long-term leases. Many of them are in situations in which they're now panicking because there's this movement to drive everything back overground, storefronts in particular. And now we have, you know, we're in the CJNU studios where, in many ways, not that this is a storefront, but it is a high traffic area where people view and see, and many of them donate to CJNU because they see the work that's being done here, particularly this glassed-in studio that we have. So what would we say, like, back in 1882, here's what happened. The government of the Governor Council of Assiniboia said, move your business by 1882 or we're going to move it for you. And so there's a heavy-handed government who then forced everybody off the ox cart trails. So far, the city's been kind of a hands-off approach, or maybe we just don't know what's happening in terms of many businesses are feeling lax and left behind down here because they don't know what's going to happen with the central circus area, which is the main driver of traffic. Will there be something addressed? Will it be a heavy-handed government? Are we just going to leave businesses to make decisions for themselves? because back in the day they built their cart right on, they built their store right on the ox cart route. If business makes decision, oftentimes it's not in the interest of the public as per se.
I have had conversations with the property owners on the four corners of Portage and Main, each of whom have their respective leases with businesses below them, and some, you know, the few leases that are in the circus, which the city of Winnipeg owns, the center part in the middle of the underground. We continue to have conversations. There's no plan immediately to close the circus. We're still looking at, you know, what would it take to close the circus? What is the $73 million was the initial number. Is there something other that can be done? I'm very open to that. I am not in any way looking to make a decision as a council that hurts or crushes businesses. And while this certainly remains open underground, because we're sitting underground right now, I think we're at the place to, with our climate, some people will continue, especially in the winter months, mm-hmm. to spend their time and go to businesses and frequent businesses in the underground because of the convenience and because they don't want to deal with the weather. My approach is this, is that let's continue as a city and as a council, both the public sector and my office, to work with these property owners to find out if there's paths that we can make everyone successful. That's really the goal. If it ultimately, though, comes down to it's going to be $73 million at least and 5 years of traffic at Portage and Main, then I maintain my position. Then, I think we need to close the underground concourse. But we're not there ultimately yet. There's time. There's discussion. People are already looking at, is there innovative ways to address the issue?
So I'm not going to throw a lot of history at you, and I'm also not going to do a 17-minute preamble to my question. You know, but which was it? You know, Negan, I got to tell you, that was impressive.
It was an incredible history lesson.
Did you notice, like, I don't think he took a breath during the whole thing. It was amazing. It's what happens when you get an academic on your podcast. The glass half full view, all the developments you're talking about, closure of streets, pedestrian mall, whatever, like the lingering dark cloud, though, is disenfranchised population downtown, mental health and substance abuse, street level crime, which, I mean, and it should be said, and we're not saying this, that people aren't doing stuff. Everybody is doing stuff. Yeah, you're doing stuff, the province, the federal government. Yeah. I think the province's experience with homelessness, though, is very instructive about how deeply, deeply embedded this problem is in the core of the city. We ran a story in this week's Free Press about people saying, yeah, you know, I'm glad you got an apartment for me, but I'm good. I want to stay living on that. Yeah. So is there something missing? Like, everybody's doing the best they can, but is there, like, how can we achieve all these bright, shiny new things, but also deal with these incredible social problems?
I'll get to the social problems in a moment. I think with all of these initiatives we're talking about, I think government at every level, whether it's municipal, provincial, federal, have a role to play. We can't do it all, nor should we try to do it all. We can't be all things to all people and all businesses. It's about the proverbial priming the pump a little bit. I think, you know, by making decisions like the Graham Avenue, turning that into a pedestrian corridor, opening Portage and Main to pedestrian traffic, working with the property owners here, using federal money for some incentives for housing, like the Housing Accelerator Fund. The goal is that primes the pump. If, you know, I grew up on a farm, I'm old enough to know there's a pump on the farm we had to prime. So I know what that means. You just put a little bit of water in, give it a few cranks, and the water begins to flow. We want to see that for development. We do our little bits as a province, feds and city, but then to attract the private sector to do that, to do the significant investment in our downtown. Let's keep in mind too, we have a massive downtown. Like, our geography of our downtown is big. And so where the areas we're talking about, they're quite a distance from one another. If you're talking to from Wayneway to Waterfront, from the Forks to Marketlands, that's quite a few steps in between there, quite a few blocks. So we're tackling a big geographic area. all through that, though, of course, we do continue to see people struggling with the social ills that face our community. It's cold comfort, I think, for a lot of Winnipeggers to know that we're not alone, that every major city in Canada is facing something very similar with people struggling unhoused, people struggling with addiction, mental health, and sometimes the crime that intersects all of that. As a city, we are committed to being in lockstep with the province of Manitoba on the Your Way Home strategy. The biggest choke point in that strategy right now is there's just not enough housing units available. I met with Minister Smith this week. I was in her office, Bernadette Smith, and I commend her. I appreciate her leadership. You know, she talked about the fact that they continue to pursue finding more housing units available and getting people, you know, out of encampments into housing with the wraparound supports they need to be successfully housed over the long term. I think, you know, to your question of, well, what about the people that say, I'm good, thanks. I just want to live outside or in a tent. Like, I want to live there. I think we should be focusing on, and we are focusing on, those people that do want to be housed. Because if we can focus on the people that are saying, I don't want to be here. I don't want to live in a tent. I don't want to live unsheltered. I want housing with supports. Let's focus on those individuals who are ready to be housed, who want to be housed, who provide kind of the greatest chance of success for those lives. And by doing that, we'll start to make a difference.
It's interesting that you've listed a few times now all the different initiatives that are investments in the downtown, and I'd say at least half of them, the ones that you've been listing, are Indigenous-led initiatives. Now, that says to you two things. One is that Indigenous organizations or governments are getting enough dollars from other outside the city means and bringing that into the city means. But it's also representing, I think, a transition point that the city's been going for quite a while, in that seeing that Indigenous peoples are the only future of the city. They're the central future of particularly the downtown. What are some efforts that are critically important for, I mean, Portage, Maine is about to become one quarter Indigenous. It was always Indigenous, or still always Indigenous. People maybe don't see it that way, because most of the people who are living here, walking around, are Indigenous on the surface anyways. They aren't allowed down here, right? They don't last very long down here, who are Indigenous peoples. They don't get in the front doors of the different businesses that are heading on this downtown area. So how would this be an Indigenous space that is not just about money, but is also about people?
As a society, I think part of our moral obligation to the other is that there's portions of the profits we use in our capitalistic society to assist the other, regardless of who they are. I think what's really exciting about the time we are seeing and involved in Winnipeg right now is that there is the true opportunity for economic development to be led by, envisioned by, First Nations, Métis, and Inuit groups, whether it's governments or, you know, organizations. So I think, again, I've described it this way many times. If you take a look at Winnipeg's downtown, and if you imagine that if you're coming from the east, Portage, Maine is the entrance to downtown. Well, right there on the corner, the Manitoba Métis Federation is at the gate of the east entrance to downtown. At the west entrance, if you're coming from the west on Portage Avenue, Portage Memorial is pretty close to the entrance of the downtown. And there, anchoring the west gate of the downtown, is Wewene, with Southern Chiefs Organization, and all that those two respective developments are what they're doing to transform our downtown, led by indigenous leadership who are visionaries and providing jobs and skills and development and services for community members. And so I think it's an exciting time for our downtown. And therefore for our city and for our province. As the province that has, or as the city that has perhaps the largest Indigenous population per capita, we should be at the forefront of working on and living out what it means to reconcile.
I mean, the north part of what you're talking about there is from the largest urban Indigenous population, which is from the north end. So I mean, the third part of what your area that you're talking about
is the north.
And of course, that's the most disenfranchised, marginalized population within the city. So that if you were talking about three directions, which is what Portage and Maine's all about, the third direction would be thinking about the social challenges or the social solutions that are found within that community as well, which of course comes from the community patrols, from innovative organizations. Seems like there's a key part within Portage and Maine that needs to be a social, cultural bend that isn't centered only on commerce, which I think is where the whole corner went wrong.
Right, right.
If you were to ask my opinion, but...
Yeah.
It's your podcast.
I think part of it, too, is the importance of relationship. Like, I try to continue, as mayor of the city, have and foster good, strong, open relationships with the leadership of all the First Nations governments and entities, whether it's the First Nations community chiefs who will pop into my office if they're from out of town visiting, or, you know, AMC, SCO, MKO, and others, Manitou Métis Federation, the Inuit Center as well. Relationship, I think, is the key to those things. And I think that the relationship is so critical for us as a council, me as mayor, to continue to build and foster. So that you don't just if and when crisis happens, you're not talking to one another for the first time in the midst of a crisis, but you've got relationship where you can work on building development, addressing social issues together, and understanding one another so that we're building a city that's mutually beneficial.
So I got to tell you that the lingering concern that I have in this discussion is, and I think the example is the supervised drug site that the province has proposed not too far from where we are right now, and the reaction to that, and the reminder that story provides that, you know, downtown, just north of here, right across from City Hall, is the beginning of one of the biggest direct service areas for disenfranchised homeless people. The shelters, soup kitchens, treatment centers, the WRHA, and then, you know, the idea that the supervised consumption might go in there as well. So, you know, the concern I have is that we just don't seem to be able to resolve the idea of whether all this development that's going on right now is about moving these people out of downtown to where we don't know, right? But somewhere, right, that the gentrification, or whether it's like we're going to create some form of new cohabitation, like they always talk about mixed development, right? Market rents and subsidized rent, all these things. It's hardly ever worked. I mean, like, it's just, it's the great white whale of urban development. And so what I think is going to happen in Winnipeg is we either invent like a new form of cohabitation, non-gentrification, but a way of moving, you know, people paying market rents in with subsidized rents, and people who are homeless, moving them in, living with people who can afford home, like, you know, to put shelter, that we come up with a new model, or else we capitulate and we just sort of fall into the, you know, I mean, I don't really mean to disparage, but Waterfront Drive, where we build $600,000 condominiums and then complain about the fact that there's still homeless people there. Like, what did you think was going to happen? So, I mean, I don't know. Like, do you sense that are we going to crack the code?
I don't know if we're going to crack the code, and I don't want this to sound too simple, but what I want to see us do together is help one person and then another person and another person. If we can, if there's an encampment of 10 people and we can get housing for all of them and 9 of it works, and people can get on with, get housing where it's secure for them, they can keep housing because they have the supports they need, then that one person can get reunited with their family, with their kids. Maybe they can get the identification they need to get back onto social assistance. Maybe they can get access to mental health supports and addictions into detox. And I kid you not, if we can help, you know, help people 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 at a time, it makes a difference for that person. It almost feels like trying to hold sand. I don't get discouraged, but it almost feels like trying to grab sand that you just runs through your fingers and go, my goodness, you know, is this an impossibility? It's going to take a long time. When I was in Houston, one of the things that I saw was that their model of housing people is they don't just put, you know, let's say take 20 people from the street and put them in all into one space, one, you know, multifamily, but there are people that go to all different parts of the city, and sometimes they're in at market rent places mm-hmm. that are subsidized. Sometimes they're in deeply affordable. But the point of the matter is, same thing that we're going to do here. Everybody has a worker, like everybody has a support yeah. worker to try to do all they can to assist them. I think my short answer to my, you know, long answer, but to the point, I think we have to do it all. We have to do it all. We have to encourage and incentivize development in the downtown of multifamily and businesses, while at the same time trying to continue to work hard to address the social challenges. I think we are seeing some change coming, which is good. All the things we talked about at the outset of this podcast, but there's still so much more work to do on homelessness, safety in the downtown, and crime.
There's a big shift in the federal government. And if we think back to the Trudeau years, there was a big shift towards civic development, or at least partnership with cities that was looking at middle-class development. Now there is this big move by the federal government to move into resource development, which is inevitably going to head towards probably more rural areas and less perhaps on infrastructure in the urban spaces. Do you have any, like, all these big ideas are going to necessarily involve conversations with the federal government? I've already heard from my sources in throughout the city that there is very little money, or much less money, for city infrastructure. And particularly I'm thinking about at the Forks, we've got that big issue with the bridge. It's very difficult to find federal dollars to support civic infrastructure at the moment. Do you foresee a problem for all of these big plans, ideas for civic development from the federal government, or do you, as they change their agenda, or are you having good conversations with that?
Yeah. One of the things, I'll be honest, one of the things I was on one hand really excited for Rebecca Chartrand, Minister Rebecca Chartrand, to take that role as minister. I was concerned, and am concerned, that for the first time in 20 years, the city of Winnipeg does not have a federal minister. But we'll continue to work with the federal government, obviously. And I spoke to the members of parliament who are elected from all the parties here, and they've all, you know, committed they're dedicated to do the work that they're going to do for, you know, to represent the city. The Prime Minister has also talked about two things. One of the things he's talked about, kind of nation building infrastructure projects. I believe that the North End plant, getting the North End treatment plant funded and fully funded, is critical to the city of Winnipeg continue to be able to grow its economy. We need the North End plant for businesses to grow. We need the North End plant for housing to be developed, because we only have 4 to 6 years of capacity left. So that continues to be a priority project that we'll continue to work with the federal and provincial partners on. Route 90 projects, Chief Pecos Trail extension, those are trade route projects. And so I see those as potentially fitting under that nation building category. The unique thing about Manitoba is we have one big city. It's the city of Winnipeg. And almost everything that happens in northern Manitoba, in one way or the other, goes through or touches the city of Winnipeg. And so by extension, I think there's some opportunity if there's resource development through and with First Nations in the north. I think there's a way for the city of Winnipeg to see some of the benefit of that, not directly, but maybe indirectly. And I'm keeping my eyes open to that as well. The final thing I'll say is that I've also paid attention to the fact that the Prime Minister has talked about the Canada meeting its NATO target. In fact, it just went from 2% of GDP investment into military to 5% target now. We have 17 wing right here in Winnipeg. We're the only city in Canada that has an Air Force wing of that size right in the heart of our city. I think there's a lot of opportunity to draw down federal money into Winnipeg and into the investment within 17 wing as well. So my eyes are on that also.
Mayor Gillingham, thank you very much for whatever reason, continuing to come back and do
not
the
your worship, not your worship, but
please,
Scott.
Thank you.
Yeah,
I appreciate.
No, but you know Scott. What? It's hard to get elected mayor, and if they call you, you should dig it, worship it.
Why not?
Go for it. You know, like we didn't ask you to
here wear on your, our podcast. You know, we will think of you as your worship.
Oh, please,
your worship. Yeah. But no, we appreciate you coming symbolically to. Just beneath Portage and Maine to talk about Portage and Maine and marching bands, fireworks. Like, what are we doing?
There'll be a ceremony, but it'll be kind of muted. I think it'll, you know, we'll have speech or two. There might be a ribbon. I don't exactly know what all will happen, but there'll be something. And I will walk across Portage and Maine at one of the streets or a couple of the streets at some point. Looking forward to it.
Try not to slow up traffic, though.
I will try not to slow up traffic.
You'll notice that as you symbolically came down on the escalators that enter the space, there is only the downworks.
Yeah, I see that.
And so I found that rather symbolic that we were able to have our podcast taping today, and hopefully the up elevator will work for you. If not, you'll be down here forever.
Yeah, that's right. Until you make a decision on whether to close it.
Right.
Yeah. Scott, thank you very much.
Yeah, amigos.
Thank you both.
So when Scott Gillingham was elected mayor, I wrote a column where, trademark, I nicknamed him the mechanic. Because I said, I talked to a lot of people about Scott Gillingham, about his time, you know, on council and like who he was and how he operated and whatever. And everybody said, well, you know, like he's not a guy for headlines. Like he's not a guy, he's not going to be on the cover of McLean's magazine trying to solve systemic racism. Sorry, Brian Bowman, that's not really a shot at you because I do appreciate what you did. But you were, you know, Brian was a little more flamboyant.
Certainly a lot more on headlines than Scott. You actually, if you ask a typical Winnipegger to identify Scott Gillingham in a line, they might not be able to because he's out there working all the time, but not always on the front page.
No, low key. But, you know, and an interesting, fascinating conversation about, you know, getting Portage and Maine reopened. And I'm not like people can have their opinions about a reopened Portage and Maine. Like it's a debate that probably deserves to continue for a little while yet. But, you know, the point is like when you hear him say, yeah, it was like $75 million to like fix the underground and whatever. And so we just knew we had to do this. We had to do it. So we got it done. You know, you and I track political decision makers and governments, and it's like I would say I don't need all the fingers on one hand to the number of times where somebody said we really needed to get something done, so we did it. That's not to say things don't get done, but usually it's a much more
longer,
painful process.
Oh, painful. You know? And if you go to the Winnipeg Free Press archive, and if you type in Portage, Maine, those two terms, I found out that we are in the thousands of course, I think probably just mentioning of events that happened there, but Portage and Maine, is the probably most talked about other than the Winnipeg football team or the Jets. Yeah. In the entirety of the paper, because people have been debating this for decades, and Scott Gillingham, if there's a legacy, here it is.
Yeah,
got it done in a couple weeks with a damning report that instigated it. Of course, there was no question that you had to do something about Portage and Maine.
Yeah,
but
he just and he didn't let Jeff Rowati get anywhere near the microphone. Sorry, Jeff. That's a really low blow too. But you know, the referendum is still on you, Jeff. So. you know, but we've evolved past that. And I think even Jeff sees the sanity in what's happening now.
It's unquestionable. Well, I mean, whether people see it as sane or insane, it's happening.
Yeah. This apparently is the segment of the podcast where I apologize to all the members of city council that I'm defaming as we talk about Portage.
That's right. Can we just lawyer up here, Adam? Have we got funding for a lawyer in the podcast?
No, my notes here just say add in the word allegedly and you should be okay.
Okay, good. Perfect. And actually, I want you to put the word in there as in your voice every time that Dan says something libelous.
Yeah. Allegedly.
Allegedly. That's right. Yeah.
Perfect.
We're going to try and squeeze in a couple more episodes. I won't do the big reveal on our special guests. But there will be more t-shirts to be handed out if we ever get t-shirts.
If.
Is it fair to say that for this episode, we have reached the time where we need to make like a tree and get out of here?
Oh, that was a Biff reference.
That was a Biff Tannen reference.
That was an obscure one. I'm gonna admit. Well, there was some debate. I'm gonna be honest. There was some debate at the start of whether the Back to the Future references were all going to be as accurate as you were just were right there, Adam. But
no, but I mean, you guys went right by fandom to like obsessive compulsive nerdy. You know, and next week our opening will be focused on Godfather 1.
Oh, jeez.
And no. Sorry.
Well, here's what I'll say is that the future is yet unwritten. There is a Doc Brown reference to Back to the Future 3. And it is a pretty interesting time in Winnipeg, as we've tried. Yeah. I think that's been the theme of today's podcast is the there's some remarkable stuff happening. And Winnipeg, for those of you that are listening outside of the city, we may have made an obscure reference or two, especially when Dan went deep down Graham Avenue. You may not have been there, but just let me tell you, it's a nice place.
You really want to go there? Like on the 17-minute
preamble?
That was
preamble? A beautiful historical trajectory. I encourage people to read that.
We were both waiting for you to keel over from a lack of oxygen during that.
I'm not even going to get into your preamble.
Okay. But thank you to you guys for, continuing to do this in the underground underneath Portage and Main, where the escalator only goes down, and we're not 100% sure about how we're going to get back out.
Are we going to be able to get out of here, Adam?
Yeah.
I don't know.
No, I don't know.
Well, thanks very much to everybody at the Free Press, as always, for supporting the podcast. Thanks to our families for continuing to put up with us, and for all of you for listening. Make Watch.